It's the Elephant in the Dome, the official podcast of the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. I'm Tracy Ellis with Senate Republican Leader John Braun. And we actually have an update from our last podcast when we talked about the big, beautiful bill and its impact on Washington, specifically when it comes to Medicaid. And we're starting to learn a little bit more about what that impact may be or may not be.
Yeah, I think more than anything that we're learning that we don't know. And so there was an interim meeting of the Senate Healthcare Committee yesterday. I'm not on that committee, but I've talked to folks who were in the meeting. A healthcare authority presented at that meeting and essentially said, we don't know how people are going to react. Just what I've been saying is the fear-mongering is way overstated. Look, by far the biggest impact is to able-bodied adults, and the new requirement is that they must either work or volunteer or study 20 hours a week, 80 hours a month, and we don't know how they're going to respond. I think it's highly likely that many of them meet the requirement. You know, that's not a high bar. It's something, if you're truly an able-bodied adult, no disabilities, no young dependents, that's not something that's unachievable. And I think many of them will. And if they do, they would continue to have Medicaid health care as their health care. There's also a fairly good chance if they do that, they would get, you know, if they exceed the 20 hours per week, that they would qualify for private health care through their new employer, in which case it wouldn't just be that they didn't lose health care, they might actually have better benefits as a result. I can't say that will happen, but it's certainly not unlikely that it will happen to some number of folks. So what was good to hear from the healthcare authority is that nothing is going to happen right away, that this doesn't start until the end of 2026, probably wouldn't even be affected during the 2027 session, and as I pointed out before, we don't know how the affected folks are going to respond, but it's reasonable to assume that they'll respond logically, which is to go meet the work requirement.
You know, what's interesting is I heard a lot of Democrats say when this was passed, well, a lot of these people already work. Well, that's good. You know, all they have to do is just say that they work now, right? I mean,
that's right. They simply have to if they already work, then problem solved, right? It's not an issue. And why all the fear mongering? The other thing we found out yesterday is that Washington State manages their SNAP program, which is the welfare or food stamps rather, supplemental nutrition assistance program, and Medicaid the same. So the work requirement on both those, it will be in one system. So managing it sounds like it is going to be more straightforward than some folks had originally suggested. So
it'll be something the state will pretty much know if a person's working.
That's right. That's right. So I mean, again, the idea that there's a work requirement for able-bodied adults without dependents is broadly supported across partisan lines. It's a pretty straightforward accountability, efficiency, make sure we're using limited federal dollars for the folks who really have the highest need. And that's just makes common sense if we're going to preserve the program for the long term, for the people who need it most.
If there's, a lot of these people already working, it shouldn't be that big of a deal to report that.
That's right.
Got some good news about auto thefts. And it's really good news. It was kind of shocking to see how much that problem that was such a severe problem just a few years ago has improved.
Really, just a year ago, in fact. Yeah. Just over a year ago, I guess. And just to put context, in 2021, we had a lot of unrest in 2020 during the summer, and the Democratic majority came back and put into place a law that required probable cause for police officers to pursue someone who had committed a crime. Well, the way that works, probable cause is such a high standard, they would literally have to have seen the crime themselves. It couldn't even be said, hey, somebody just stole that car. They would have to see that. Practically to go pursue. So we had almost no pursuit in our state from 2021 until last year, 2024, when we finally prevailed and fixed the law. But we saw it go from, and auto thefts is a good example. It goes to other places, but this is the one good data since I think 2002. It spiked up to over 3,500 per month for most of the following year. And as high as 4,000 auto thefts per month. For a while, I think we're the second highest auto thefts in the country. It was just it was a crisis, and people will say, well, that's property crime. We don't care about that. It's much more than that. If you're a single parent and that's your automobile to get yourself to and from work and your child to and from school, this is a really big deal to a lot of people. Anyhow, Republicans fought that law for several years. We were able to push back on it incrementally, but then, as you probably recall, in 2023, going into the 2024 session, over 400,000 voters signed an initiative to put it in front of the legislature, initiative to the legislature, and we were able to prevail, convincing the Democrat majorities to vote with us, to at least most of them, to vote with us to put that into law, repeal the 2021 law saying it required probable cause, go take it back to reasonable suspicion, which is where it had been forever before that, allow officers to use their training to determine if it's safe to pursue or not, because that was the concern, right? And we don't want to hurt innocent bystanders because we pursue in an unsafe situation. What we learned in all this is there is very rigorous training for law enforcement officers to make sure they make the right call in pursuit. Every evidence is they are now. And here's the really good win. It turns out when you enforce the law, fewer people break the law. And our auto thefts have plummeted to below $1,500 per month, which has never been that low in the time we recorded it.
Yeah, and you mentioned part of the good news there is that we haven't heard of a lot of accidents related to pursuits either. You know, I think people may not understand that it's not just the call of the one officer. It's the call of their supervisor. A lot of people are involved in making these decisions on pursuits.
That's right. I think that the Democratic majority did not fully appreciate the level of training that already existed, the level of checks that leaders in law enforcement have put in place in their offices or departments to make sure that, you know, they pursue when it's appropriate, when either there's a threat if they don't pursue, or if they're going to pursue that it doesn't cause some unexpected hazard to bystanders. So we're doing the right thing. And even the numbers they used when they put the law in place in 2021, claiming some, you know, I've actually looked at the numbers, the number of injuries as a result of unintended injuries as a result of pursuit was very low. It wasn't zero, and we should be alert to that. We don't want to hurt anybody, but we can't do it at the cost of law and order across the state. It was just bedlam for a few years when this law was in place.
Talk a little bit about how Republicans slowly kind of chipped away at this and got eventually enough Democrats to support changing the law. How did you go about doing that? A lot of people out there say Republicans, when you're in the minority, there's really not a lot you can do. And to a certain extent, they're right. But this is an example of something that was very important to Republicans that you pushed on, but you figured out a way to get Democrats to kind of come over to your side on this.
Well, I think it comes down to two things. It comes down to data. What happened is they chose to make a very significant policy change and in the idea that they're going to save lives from unintended consequences. And over time, we just kept working on them and say, look, you're not doing what you intended to do, virtually no change in the data. And we have this really what turned out to be a crisis. We went from being relatively low nationally to the one of the worst, and at times the worst, in terms of auto theft in the country. We just had a spree, and that's just one item. That wasn't all the retail theft that was happening at the same time. And so one is the data and them seeing what's happening in front of them. I know we saw, especially in the urban core of the state in the Puget Sound, we saw, in addition to auto theft, we had retail theft, and we had, you know, entire stores just shutting down. And so they had deserts, you know, retail deserts in urban areas because they couldn't stay in business if things were being stolen all the time, and they made a logical decision. So some of it is the facts made the case all by themselves, and some of it is just building relationships with the other side and say, look, you have to admit this doesn't make any sense. Common sense tells us that if we want laws in place to be adhered to, we're going to have to have we're going to have to enforce them. There's going to have to be consequences when people break the law. And law enforcement are an unwinnable situation. If they can't pursue a lawbreaker, They have no way, virtually no way. I mean, they'll make the argument, you know, there's other, you know, follow-up they can do, but effectively no way of holding them accountable for their lawlessness.
The news isn't quite so good with juvenile rehabilitation, another area where Republicans have been pushing and pushing for change. It's especially important to you because a major juvenile rehabilitation facility is in the Chehalis area in your district. And it's had some problems. There was a King 5 report. You were featured on it. It talked about drugs being smuggled in, employees, essentially, I guess, like guards, having sexual relationships with the people who are in the offenders. What's going on there, and what are you trying to do to help fix the situation?
Well, there's a couple different problems. The underlying problem, which is caused by the policy put in place by the Democratic majority some years ago called JR-25, which allows folks who committed a crime as a juvenile with sentence as an adult to stay in the juvenile rehabilitation program until they're 25 years old. There's some problems inherent with that, and I won't go into that too much. But what the biggest issue is that has just driven the population in our juvenile rehabilitation schools way up. In particular, Green Hill, where they're sending most of the older offenders.
That's the one in Chehalis.
Green Hill School, which has been in Chehalis, been there for, you know, I think over 100 years. It's a long, long time facility, modernized now, of course. But we've had this explosion, and it was up in the 240, 250 range, recognize that system is built to handle 180. So well above, almost 50% above their capacity. And this was causing all kinds of safety issues for staff, safety issues for residents. They aren't and weren't and still to a large degree are not delivering the types of rehabilitative services this whole thing is built on. Remember, we're doing this with the idea, whether you like it or not, and I thought the bill was not fully thought out when we voted against it, but whether you like it or not, the mission is to help these young folks get back on a better track. And when it's so crowded, we can't deliver those services. You're not doing anything. So that's been the core issue. We fought hard to give Department of Children, Youth, and Families more tools to manage that population. That's a bill that ultimately died on the floor of the House after coming out of the Senate unanimously, died in kind of a partisan battle. Over another much more egregious bill from the Democrats that would essentially allow all these folks who in most cases have committed very violent crimes, by the way, to stay out of juvenile rehabilitation at all. Very dangerous policy. Anyhow, so we continue with that struggle. At the same time, and probably contributing to each other, we've had some significant misbehavior by staff. And you mentioned that we've had, you know, instances of staff smuggling in drugs for residents. We've had sexual encounters between residents and staff, stuff that, you know, is just unacceptable by anybody. And I want to be clear, there's about 300 staff in Green Hill. The vast majority are dedicated public servants. They understand the mission. They're committed to the mission. It's a small number of staff who are committing these what are really criminal acts. But it can't be allowed to continue. We have to stand up and push back and say, we can't be credible. We can't be believable on this issue and in this program if we continually, this constant drip of one more staff member that's broke the law is just killing us. And it's killing their reputation for the entire staff group, which is unfortunate. Because as I said, most of them, the vast majority, are committed to doing the right thing for the residents. But somehow this is happening. The story you mentioned highlight someone who had been found out to be doing bad things and criminal things, frankly, was now trying to smuggle. Came as a delivery driver, tried to smuggle in drugs inside of a burrito.
This woman was fired and convicted of crimes related to what she did at Green Hill. Was fired, served time in prison, came back and got a job in the Centralia Chehalis community delivering burritos or whatever. It was filling those burritos up with drugs for the residents there at the school. I mean, it's just one of those, it's like, you want to say, well, listen, really, it should you be letting her of all people be bringing food to offender? You know what I mean?
It's hard. You couldn't. It's like you could invent this stuff if you tried. It's so outrageous. It's hard to believe. And the good thing is, I think we're a long ways from having this solved. But I think we certainly have the agency's attention, and they are focused on that. I met with the Secretary of Department of Children, Youth, and Families last week. It was a good meeting.
This is something, you know, you mentioned the Department of Children,
Youth and Families.
Youth and Families. It just seems odd to me that this isn't a facility run by the Department of Corrections, which has experience in running, you know, prisons, but, you know, also facilities like this. That in itself, I think, would be a challenge. I mean, this other agency is really set up to take care of kids, and this is, you know, a different situation.
That's right. I mean, and for many years, it was run by the Department of Corrections. It was only, I think, in 2017 where they expanded. We expanded Department of Children, Youth, and Families, where juvenile rehabilitation was moved over there. The idea that these are young folks who've got on the wrong track, perhaps there's some synergy between that and other programs for children. I didn't buy it then. I don't buy it now. This is running a prison, and granted, it's a prison with services. It's a prison that's trying to get these young folks back on a good track, and I support all that sort of thing. But in the end, it is all the things that have, you know, much more commonality with the prison system than with foster care or child protective services, the type of thing the Department of Children, Youth, and Families do. So there is, I think, a mismatch there. And I think that's a philosophical mismatch where the Democratic majorities think that's where it belongs. And I think common sense and Republicans think, no, it's not fitting there. I would add to that, when you go talk to the folks in the Department of Corrections and you say, you know, where is your most challenging group? They will tell you 19 to 25. So we're literally taking the most challenging inmates in corrections and moving them to this different facility, not equipped, not staffed, not really thought out how we would deliver services with what is already historically a challenging group of convicted folks.
So what is the Secretary of DCYF saying?
Well, many things she's saying, I think, are right. She seems to understand that we have to be doing things. They need the tools to manage the population. She seems to understand that they can't deliver on the promise, which is, you know, young folks back on a better track, leaving good lives. They can't deliver on that unless we get population under control. So there's a lot of common ground we can work from. We don't agree on everything there, but I think that I do, and she's brand new. I take her in good faith that she's focused on fixing this and fixing this the right way. I think she would. I certainly want to speak for her, but I've read, and I think I could say that she agrees. You know, they added the short term fix was to add another small facility over in Grays Harbor. They call Harbor Heights. I think everybody involved would agree that that's not the ultimate solution, right? This is kind of a Band-Aid to help bring down the total census level, but a number of people at Green Hill. But that didn't really fix it. We have to find a better way. And I think there's
a couple, the fix. That, yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, to me, it's pretty clear. The very simple fix would be to undo JR-25. I think politically there's not a path to do that, but I think that's the simplest fix. It's not really showing the promise that they believed it would, and it's turned out to be very hard and very expensive, by the way. You know, we spend roughly, I think, $60,000 a year on somebody in corrections. We spend about $250,000 a year for someone in juvenile rehabilitation. So it's expensive. We're not really delivering the services, and therefore we're not getting the outcomes we wanted. I mean, so I think it's about managed population and those, especially the older groups. You got to take, you know, be hard-nosed about, is this, if we're going to do this, is that person committed to the path? I mean, are they committed to the services, whether it's education or trade skills or just, you know, different individual personal management skills to allow them to be successful in the future? If they're committed, then sure, that's what we've signed up for. But there's a whole lot of folks there that simply aren't. And it's not a secret. You've talked to staff there. They can tell you, you know, which individuals there really want to make their lives better, really want to buy in and fix the program, and which ones are just, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, just doing their time until, and most of those folks, they're going to do their time at juvenile rehabilitation, and then because they've been convicted of very serious crimes at their 25th birthday, they're going to get moved to corrections anyhow. Why not move them earlier? It's a different set of services. It's not like we don't deliver some services at corrections. It's a different set. It may be a better fit for them long term, and it will help relieve the crowding at Green Hill.
Overall, when it comes to the criminal justice system here in our state, do you feel like not just criminal justice, I mean, you know, all this stuff, I mean, criminal justice, youth rehabilitation, do you feel that Democrats are coming around to some of these things overall? You know, we talked about the auto thefts and how they did seem to come around to the pursuit law. I've heard some Democrats say, yeah, we're with you, Senator Braun, on this juvenile rehabilitation. We definitely need to make changes there. But are you starting to see any kind of a shift among Democrats toward a different approach than they've taken in the past?
Yeah, I think you can definitely say there's two different camps on the Democratic side. Some, just as you described, who said, you know, they have compassion for these young folks. They would like to see them have better lives, but they also understand what we're doing is not working. In fact, maybe making it worse, and it's very expensive, and are open to providing more flexibility to the department to manage population. And then there's this small but very vocal, very aggressive group who really are committed to reducing sentences, letting people out early, without really thinking through or acknowledging the real risk, you know, physical risk to folks in doing that. You know, one of the things that came up, you know, I said earlier I had a bill that would help give additional options for the department to manage population. The bill that the Democrats tried to link with it took a different approach to the problem and essentially made it easier to prevent folks, you know, young folks who have been convicted from even going into the juvenile rehabilitation program. And that kind of blew up on them within their own caucus in the House, because near the end of session, they had a young person who had been convicted of a violent offense, and the judge put him back in the community, and he ended up murdering two people. And so they, you know, the clear-eyed folks on the Democratic side say, yeah, we can't do that. That can't be the response. Because people will get hurt. People are getting hurt. And this is the other misleading thing about juvenile rehabilitation. This is not the juvenile rehabilitation of 10, 20, certainly not 30 years ago, where you have folks in there for shoplifting or some relatively minor crime. Almost the entire population, there are exceptions, but most of the population are in there for violent crime, murder, assault, some sort of a physical, you know, violence was involved. These aren't the sort of folks you just say, I think they'll do better next time. Let's put them back on the street. We're going to turn them around, if they're going to get their lives on a better track, and I don't say we can't do that, they're going to need more intensive services. They're going to have to show up in juvenile rehabilitation. You can't do that with an ankle bracelet and hope for the best.
Yeah, but you mentioned it earlier. You said, you know, some of these things are very expensive. I mean, a lot of this is very expensive. Yeah, money is a problem for the legislature. It continues to be a problem. I mean, are there going to be ways? Is there going to be enough money to deal with these issues? I mean, these are serious issues, you know?
Well, depends on who's writing the budget. From my perspective, I feel very confident, and we just saw our budget leads in the Senate Republican caucus do this in the last session. We could write a budget that delivers on these services and lives within our means. Absolutely could do that. But it does take hard decision making. You got to make hard decisions like, okay, who in this group is really committed to turning their lives around? And we're going to help those folks. And who is not? And we're going to give them a different option that because they're not engaged. They're not participating, and they may be better served, and certainly the state would be better served, and it would be less cost effective to put them somewhere else. So that takes hard decision making. We need to be doing that. That's what the taxpayers expect us to do.
Budgets are about decisions, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't mean we can't be compassionate. It doesn't mean we can't be committed to getting folks back on a better path. But we can't just, you know, we can't just throw money at the problem and think we're going to fix it. We got to engage. We got to actually be committed to turning their lives around and understanding it's not going to work for everybody.
Do you think there's enough money in the system right now if you just were to spend it in a different way?
Oh, absolutely. I 100% believe we could get the same or perhaps even better results if we focus and said, all right, we're going to narrow it down to the folks we can truly help get on a better path, and we're going to provide a different option for everybody that's not truly committed. Now, I think if you did that, you would change people's behavior over time. Maybe when they see, hey, I don't just get to hang out at Green Hill without any services in a pretty comfortable place unless I commit, maybe they would commit, or maybe they wouldn't. I don't know. It's a choice, but we would at least be saying we're not going to invest, you know, hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars in turning your life around, helping you turn your life around. And I put it that way because the state can't do it. They got to do it for themselves. We could just help. But we're not going to do that unless you're in, unless you're all in and really committed. We're not going to do that. That's where we got to be if we're going to have real success. Because what happens right now is the folks are who would or who are or could be truly committed, they're getting drowned out by all the chaos and the frankly, the unsafe situation.
So they can't, get the services.
Yeah, as a result, they're not getting the services, or they're getting not all the services that would help them get on a better path. It's just, you know, there's no, the misbehavior by other residents that we're allowing to happen is pulling everybody else down.
That's Senator John Braun, the Senate Republican leader. I'm Tracy Ellis. This is the Elephant in the Dome, the official podcast of the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus.